Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we want to start today with a look at how local nurses are faring while confronting the global coronavirus pandemic. In a new poll, WBUR surveyed 402 nurses across Massachusetts. And here with the results is Steve Cozzella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, which conducted the survey. Welcome back, Steve.
Glad to be here.
So, Steve, can you give us the key findings from the survey?
Sure. So this was a survey of nurses who said that they were in some way involved in dealing with the coronavirus crisis, even in either in terms of dealing with caring directly for patients or in some other way. And we found a lot of interesting things. You know, this is a group we've heard a lot from voters, but not directly from nurses. So we found some views in common with what voters have been telling us. Very high approval, for instance, for the way that Governor Charlie Baker's handling the crisis. 87% of nurses dealing with the coronavirus crisis approve of the way Charlie Baker's dealing with it. Also very high levels of approval for Dr. Anthony Fauci and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. And another feature that's shared in common with how voters in Massachusetts feel, not a lot of love for Donald Trump. Only a third of nurses approve of the way that Trump is handling it. We also looked a lot at things like whether there's enough personal protective equipment, enough testing, and how individual nurses had been faring in terms of what they were doing for the job, and also whether they thought they might have been exposed to the disease, to the illness themselves. Those were some of the other topics that we explored.
Well, let's stay with PPE for a second. You talked about that. Today, Governor Baker said the state's distributed more than 9 million pieces of PPE so far, but we do still hear stories about shortages. What did you find from the data?
Right. So we asked the question of whether your place of work has enough PPE right now. And we found that among this group, 44% said, no, we do not have enough. So there's still a very widespread feeling that the amount of PPE that's been distributed is currently not adequate. And the number is actually a bit higher if you look only at nurses who said that they're involved directly in patient care. There it's about half, it's exactly half of nurses who say that the amount of PPE that their place of work has currently is not sufficient.
So there was another set of numbers that really were striking. First, 1 in 5 nurses said they felt constantly in personal danger of catching the virus. But at the same time, I mean, this is a constant sense of fear and stress. You found that nurse morale remains high. So can you kind of square that for us?
Yeah, I thought it was quite remarkable the level of resolution that nurses are showing given the issues that they're facing. So there's a very high feeling of personal danger you just mentioned. There's also the feeling that there's not necessarily the equipment that they need in all cases in terms of PPE. There's many say that they've either had the symptoms or 3% said they've actually tested positive already. So there's a feeling that maybe your colleagues are in danger. And even despite all of this, we found a very strong majority have described their morale as either high or moderate. So the comparison that came to mind for me was actually soldiers. For those who don't know, I was in the Army myself, and the set of dynamics that they're experiencing, you know, long hours, that was another thing, much longer hours than usual. It's in many ways a younger group that's dealing directly with patients, not enough equipment. You know, you don't have the stuff you need, but you're doing something that really matters and you feel is really important. That set of things really evoked for me memories of being in the Army, you know, and really having that sense of purpose that you're doing something that A is your job, but B also has a very strong sense of purpose attached to it.
Why did you decide to do a poll focused on nurses? What were you hoping to learn from that?
Yeah, well, this was a poll that I think looked at a group that there's a lot of anecdotal information out there about. You know, we read a lot of news coverage about individual hospitals or something that a specific hospital leader or nurse might have said, but we didn't really know exactly what that would translate to if we tried to quantify it. So we know that there's been stories about PPE and these wild stories of different institutions trying to get what they needed. And, you know, here in Massachusetts, of course, the whole thing that happened with the New England Patriot plane, you know, extreme measures gone to get PPE. But where does that leave us? That was the question. Where does that leave the actual nurse standing there in front of a coronavirus patient, you know, caring for that patient? Do they have what they need? So this was an effort to really put some numbers around what has all of that turned into. How many of those anecdotes are actually representative of what frontline nurses are going through at this point?
So Steve, before we let you go, I just want to pivot. You recovered from the coronavirus. So let me ask you, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel fine at this point. And I'll say that I, you know, don't exactly know that that's what it was because I was not able to get tested at the time. I've taken a couple of the notoriously inaccurate blood tests and they've come back negative, much to my surprise.
Oh.
So it leaves me sort of in a very mystified state, as many other people are too, as far as, you know, you feel like you've gone through it. But what did we really actually have? A lot of the, actually that is in common with the poll, where the number who said that they had the symptoms and got tested was much higher than the number who actually said they tested positive. So I'm not totally sure what to make of that, but I would guess that's something we'll all know a lot more about in the months to come.
Well, either way, we're glad that you're better now. And that's Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thank you.
So I want to turn now to Marlena Pellegrino. She is a frontline medical surgical nurse at St. Vincent Hospital, also co-chair of the Nurses Local Bargaining Unit with the Massachusetts Nurses Association at her hospital. Welcome back, Marlena.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So I want to ask you, 60% of the nurses surveyed say they feel in personal danger of catching the virus at least some of the time at work, and nearly one in five feels that basically all the time. Do you feel that fear, and how does that weigh on you?
We definitely feel that fear. I'd say that especially when you're driving into work, you're coming into your shift, and when you're leaving for your shift. But when you finally get to the hospital, I think a sense of determination and calm comes over you. You know that these patients need you, so you're going in to do what you can to care for patients. But we also talk among ourselves, of course, and most of the nurses I work with, you know, it weighs heavily on your mind when you're at home with your families. And the conversation is not if I may get the virus, it's the conversation is when. When will I get the virus? And that's how nurses at the bedside feel. We talk about that, and we try to resolve that among ourselves to try to comfort one another and try to get through this crisis. But it's a real fear, and it does take an emotional and physical toll on nurses every day.
We just heard Steve Cazella, I'm sure you heard it, compare what you are going through in this experience with military service. What's your reaction to that analogy?
I think that he's spot on. When we're walking into the hospital, we feel you're entering a very unknown situation. It's like a war zone. You don't know what you're going to be hit with at any given moment. Things can change. They evolve very quickly, minute to minute, hour to hour. You don't have the proper tools that you need. Sometimes you don't have the exact support that you need, but you have one another. So you become very strong and very resolute in your purpose, knowing that people need you. You have a certain skill that you want to help people. But it definitely is relying on one another for that moral support. And we know that we can't let one of us fall. If one of us falls and many of us fall, then who's going to be able to take care of the patients? So it's a perfect analogy because it is walking into a form of a war zone.
You just made a reference a minute ago to not having all the equipment that you need. About half of the nurses surveyed say their workplace does have enough personal protective equipment for nurses caring for COVID-19 patients, but 44% say they don't. I know you're provided with masks and gowns at your hospital, but do you feel like you have enough PPE?
We have very inconsistent PPE, I'd say. It's quite scattered. It changes frequently. It changes day to day. We do not have the standard of PPE that we would normally have if this was not a pandemic. If the CDC did not water down the standards, we would never be reusing gowns, which we are required to do. We reuse our N95 masks, which we would not normally ever do. We're washing down our own face shields, in between patients. So it is not a standard where nurses feel safe coming into the hospital. There is PPE there, but like I said, it's kept to a minimum, and it can become very chaotic trying to manage it. And it is a fear factor in trying to care for these patients. You don't want to expose yourself. You don't want to expose your patient to becoming any more ill than they are. So it's definitely something that I can understand when nurses, responded to that. That's the reality in the hospital today.
Marlene, I know you know that communities are really wanting to thank frontline medical personnel and show a lot of support, applauding nurses on their way to work, sending free meals. Tell us and tell our listeners, what do you really need most right now?
You know, we're so very appreciative, and the public has been unbelievably gracious to nurses, so generous, sending food, sending, homemade masks, anything. I think the public just wants to reach out and do something. But the main thing we need to do, our jobs, we need appropriate staffing in the hospital. These patients that we are caring for, COVID-19 patients, are unbelievably ill, fragile. They're vulnerable. You know, obviously they are isolated. They're alone. There are no family members allowed, no visitors. So frontline nurses, registered nurses, are there to fill. We're filling their emotional needs, their physical needs, of course, their spiritual needs, all in one person. There's a tremendous challenge in that. We want to care for our patients properly. So I would say to advocate to put as much pressure as possible. We need the appropriate amount of staffing to care for our patients, and we need the proper amount of PPE to do our jobs.
That is Marlena Pellegrino. She's a nurse at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester and also co-chair of the Nurses Local Bargaining Unit with the Massachusetts Nurses Association at her hospital. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for your work. May is National Mental Health Month, and a little later in the show, two mental health professionals will take your calls on experiencing or living with anxiety or depression during the pandemic. But first, we want to turn to someone who has made mental health services a focus of his work in Congress. Seth Moulton represents the Massachusetts 6th District, joins us now on the line from Salem. Welcome back, Congressman.
Great to be back. How are you?
So, I'm well, thank you. And I actually want to ask you the same thing, because the last time we had you on air, you were in isolation with symptoms of COVID-19. How are you?
100% better. My wife and I have fully recovered, and I'm glad to report once again that my 18-month-old daughter never had any symptoms at all. So she
very
got COVID
for free.
Thanks
so
for
before the break, yeah, absolutely. We've been thinking about everyone who's going through this, because it's challenging and it's such an unknown time. Before the break, Congressman, we reported that 60% of Massachusetts nurses say they feel that they're in personal danger of catching the coronavirus when they go to work. I kind of want to get your reaction to those numbers from the poll. The nurses also, about 44%, said they didn't have enough PPE. What is your reaction to how you're hearing that they're feeling during this pandemic?
Well, we're hearing the exact same thing. And frankly, they are the warriors on the front lines of this new war. And just like people like myself returned from Iraq or Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress, we should absolutely expect that the nurses and doctors who are fighting this life and death battle will have mental health consequences. I've got a number to share with you. In April, there was a 1,000% increase in calls to the Federal Disaster Distress Hotline. And, you know, one way to think about this is that a certain percentage of Americans are becoming actually infected with the virus. But every single one of us is feeling in some way or another the mental health consequences of social distancing, of the isolation, or of just being scared that we're going to get this or a relative is going to get sick and even die.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I know last night you and the Samaritans of Boston hosted an online event on mental health in this crisis. What did you hear from people?
What we heard is that this is a real issue and people need help. And a lot of people just don't know what to do if they're concerned that a friend or a family member is having a mental health issue. And that's why I'm working so hard to get this new bill, the National Suicide Hotline Designation Act, passed that would established 988 as the three-digit national hotline for suicide prevention and mental health crisis for the simple reason that a lot of people just don't even know whom to call for help when they or a loved one is going through a mental health issue. You know, if you think about it, you wake up in the middle of the night and your house is on fire. You don't have to go rummaging through your stuff to find a phone book to know whom to call, right? But the fact that, I mean, do you know what the National Suicide Hotline is?
No.
I mean, not to put you on the spot, but hardly anyone does. I don't think I could even tell you it right now. And that's the problem, is we all need to know who to call. So if we make 988 the national number, everybody will know if you have a mental health emergency, pick up the phone, dial 988, and you'll immediately get connected to help. We're working really hard to get this included in the next part of the CARES Act funding.
So how far along, I mean, is that all that's left to do is the CARES Act funding and then it could go live?
Essentially, there's already been a national study conducted by the federal government to determine the best number. That's how we came up with 988. The bill includes the funding mechanism, just like the 911 system, so that every city and town can make sure that they're connected. And then there's some companion legislation that would ensure enough funding so that there are enough people to staff all the call centers, which already in this pandemic are experiencing such a dramatic increase in calls. But the bottom line is that every day that goes by and more people have an emergency like this and don't know who to call, don't know what the number is, more people are dying. So this bill will save lives the day that it's passed. And that's why we're working so hard. By the way, not just bipartisan in the House, but bipartisan in the Senate as well. It's a bipartisan, bicameral effort to get this included in the next round of relief legislation. I've had two phone calls with the White House. Which I'll tell you, a phone call with the White House, with the Trump White House, is not a normal thing for me in this administration. Had two calls with them in the past 2 weeks to make sure they're on board as well.
And one of our producers just sent a note in to me just to let everyone know, actually, we do have the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. So if that's something that you're looking for or that you think you need out there, that number is 1-800-273-8255. Congressman, this is a personal issue for you. You've advocated for mental health services. Last year, you were openly discussed your own struggles with PTSD following your 4 tours in Iraq. Why is it important to open up about those challenges?
You know, I decided to share my personal story because I was inspired by some of the veterans I served with, many of them younger than me, who were willing to share their story, and it made it, I could see what a difference it was making in the lives of others. Because when you share a story like this, you make other people who may be going through some of the same challenges realize that they're not alone, and that being willing to talk about this and actually seek help is the way to get better. So frankly, I didn't say anything for a long time because I was scared of the political consequences. I'll be, you know, free to admit that. I was scared of the political consequences. But I was also doing this at a time when I was running for president. And I said, you know what, if I'm running for such an important leadership position, I ought to be able to lead by example, like I've seen so many other veterans do when they share their stories of dealing with post-traumatic stress. And so that's why I decided to share mine.
Conversation is starting to change. Do you think there will be a time when somebody who's running for a national office can be open about those experiences and not have to be afraid of the political consequences?
I certainly hope so. I was the first presidential candidate in history to do so, but I was pleasantly surprised by the incredible reaction. It was very positive. I mean, I thought I might be drummed out of the race the next day. Instead, I received calls from across the country from people who said thank you. And I still today get people coming up to me all the time and saying, thank you for sharing your story. It's helped me share mine. It's helped me get help. Or I know a friend or a relative who's been able to get help themselves. So I think we're getting there. But we're far from where we really need to be as a country, where mental health care is just as routine as physical health care. You know, if you think about it, if I were to show up late for work and say, I'm sorry, you know, I had to go get a physical, everyone would just have a normal reaction to that. No one would be concerned at all. But if you say, oh, I'm going to be late for work because I'm going to have a mental health appointment, the reaction would probably be quite different. And it shouldn't be. It should be just the same. I'm trying to make mental health care as routine as physical health care. And we'll be a stronger, more resilient nation if we can get there.
Do you think the Commonwealth right now is doing enough for mental health services during the pandemic?
I know the Commonwealth is trying. I know that Massachusetts is ahead of the curve in delivering mental health resources. But I don't think anyone's where we need to be. I still know that people in Massachusetts are scared to admit they have problems or have difficulty finding the resources they need to get help. This is a very serious issue that's really been exacerbated and perhaps in a good way highlighted by this pandemic. In the same way that many veterans have set the example of being willing to seek care for mental health issues, I think we'll see doctors and nurses do the same coming out of this pandemic and be able to share with their friends and relatives and maybe even their patients that it's okay to seek help when you have a mental health issue. And frankly, I think we need to get to the point where even you don't even have to wait for a crisis. You know, to use the analogy again of going to get a physical, if you pass your physical with flying colors, the doctor would probably still take some time to say, you know, are you staying in shape? Are you eating healthy foods? And that should be the same with mental health. There are a lot of things that we can do, things like mindfulness training, for example, something now being practiced by our elite special forces, to simply get our minds in better shape. So maybe we help prevent a crisis, so stave off mental health issues by just being mentally strong throughout our lives. That's certainly something I'm much more conscious of now in my own life. And I think it makes me a better congressman. I think it makes me a better leader. I think it makes me a better husband and a better dad to just be taking care of my own mental health.
I'd like to pivot to some national news. We mentioned earlier you ran for president last year and suspended your campaign in August, and then you endorsed the presumptive nominee Joe Biden at the end of January. Mm-hmm. I know you know that Biden is facing allegations from a former Senate staffer of sexual assault. What's your reaction to those allegations?
Well, Vice President Biden has unequivocally denied the allegation and called for a full investigation into Tara Reade's claim because he believes, as I do, that all women should be heard and taken seriously when they raise these kinds of allegations. I think he's made an unprecedented call for transparency in asking the Senate to open their archives and search personnel files for any record of Reade's complaint. And I think it's also worth saying that, you know, he was thoroughly vetted when he was picked as Barack Obama's vice presidential running mate. And the people involved in that process have said that nothing like this allegation ever came up. So I think that the vice president is handling this as anyone should, calling for a full investigation, taking it seriously, making sure that the allegations are heard.
What about criticisms of the Democratic Party that there's a hashtag MeToo double standard here? You know, Biden gets support, still has the support among party leadership, gets a call for due process that maybe others accused of sexual misconduct have not.
Well, Vice President Biden has soberly and aggressively called for a full investigation here. And, you know, that's quite a contrast, for example, to when Brett Kavanaugh and his supporters rejected an investigation and behaved incredibly defensively in the hearing about the allegations. So I think the party's handling this appropriately, and I think the vice president is too. We're taking this seriously. We're calling for an investigation. I think, frankly, all Democrats are doing that, and the vice president is setting the right example.
Last question on this. He's the presumptive nominee, but he is not yet the nominee of the party. Some have said that with these allegations hanging over him, he ought to step aside. Do you think that's right?
No, I think that now if the investigation were to come out differently than everyone expects, then that's a different story. But from everything we know right now, he is the nominee because he's gone through an incredibly difficult process, a process that that I was not successful at, and he was, and that's the process by which we choose the nominee for our party, and we should respect that.
Congressman, I'd really like to end where we began, which is with the issue of mental health. After a break in a minute, we're going to take calls with mental health professionals for listeners who may be struggling with anxiety or depression. And I just wonder what your message is to the people of Massachusetts listening right now who may just really be struggling to keep it together in this scary time.
My message is that you're not alone and that this is a scary time. It's a scary time for all of us. And so it's okay to admit that you need help. It's okay to ask for help, to call a friend or call a professional to get better. This is hard. I have every confidence that we're going to get through this as a community, as a country. We are going to get through this, but it's not easy. Nobody's saying that it's easy. And you should know that we're all in this together.
And that's Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents Massachusetts 6th District. Congressman Moulton, I'm glad that you're better, and I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And just before the break, we talked with Congressman Seth Moulton as we're observing National Mental Health Month this month. Now, I'm married to a psychiatrist who works with severe anxiety and depression, so it's something that we talk about at home. And the team here at Radio Boston has talked a lot about mental health during this time of deep fear and physical isolation. We thought we could learn more, and we wanted to invite you to call with your thoughts and questions, too. Are you having new feelings of anxiety or sadness during this pandemic? Did you have anxiety or depression before the pandemic? And if so, is it better or worse now? And are you worried about a loved one? Have a question for our guests about that? Or maybe actually you feel less alone in your anxiety now. Whatever it is, call us. Talk to us about it. Ask questions. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. And we have two mental health professionals who are joining us today to talk about it and help take those calls. First, we have Susan Tone, an associate professor of clinical practice at the Boston College School of Social Work. She's a licensed clinical social worker and has her own therapeutic practice. Susan, welcome.
Thanks.
We also have Dr. Edward Silberman, a psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Silberman.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So let me ask you both first, how are your clients, your patients? Are they doing better now, worse now? It's about the same. Susan, why don't you start?
Okay, Tiziana, thanks so much. I would say it is mixed. I think the general narrative out there is that people are struggling more. So I certainly have people who I work with for whom being at home is harder than when they were able to go to work and be out in the world and feel productive. And then I also have people who have either generalized anxiety, which means that they worry about bad things happening sort of all the time. And I can think of one person in particular who said to me, I feel so much better. I feel more relaxed. I am not as anxious because all of you are worrying now. It used to just be me and I had to carry the load. So it was really a fabulous comment, and it made me sort of pause to say, you know, I shouldn't assume that the narrative is the same for everybody, that everybody's struggling. For some people, this is sort of a little bit of a relief because they don't have to be the only one who's worrying.
Dr. Silberman,
people with social anxiety for whom interacting with people is very challenging and causes them to use a lot of energy, which they then can't use to actually do their jobs. For them, working at home has been much better and they've been more productive.
Dr. Silberman, how does that compare or contrast to what you're seeing with your patients?
I suspect that I have a somewhat different clientele. People who see a psychiatrist are more likely perhaps to have a real diagnosable mental disorder going into it. Now, I will say I'm not the sort of psychiatrist who just writes prescriptions for medication. I do a lot of psychotherapy also. So I see a range of people, but they almost all had some kind of diagnosable pre-existing condition. And so I think that my experience has been much more toward people having a harder time. because their natural outlets have been restricted. They're deprived of many of the things that they normally do, including, in some cases, getting out of the house every day and having a different workplace to go to, as well as having restricted contact with friends and even getting out of the house. Now, interestingly, the way I can relate most to what Susan said is if I look at myself, because I notice that my own tendency to tell myself, oh, I'm not accomplishing enough, I'm not doing enough, I'm wasting some time, has diminished a little bit, because I think to myself, oh, well, but everybody's in this situation. I have no choice but to spend the time the way I'm spending it. So I really can't worry about not being more productive. So I think I'm in that range myself.
I have more questions for both of you, but our listeners are calling. We have lots of calls. And so I'd really like to just jump right in. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's start with Angela, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, Angela?
Well, I'm a little anxious right now. I've got PTSD, and I do have an outstanding psychiatrist. But with everything that's been going on, you know, I'm 78 years old. I have heart-lung disease and I had surgery for an aneurysm. And, you know, so I'm vulnerable. So I've been staying in and staying away from everybody. But as you pointed out, that's kind of isolating. And then I had a text from my son who just wants to blame me for everything that went wrong in his life. And that didn't help very much either. So I wanted to thank the congressman for speaking out and speaking up and saying, you know, people with PTSD have got an extra burden. And right now it's troubling some of us.
Angela, I appreciate your call, and I'm sorry that you're struggling with that and that you're having an even more anxious and hard time. I'll turn to Susan Tone. One of the things that Angela said there, Susan, was that she appreciated the congressman talking about his own experience. How important is it right now for people who are feeling anxiety or feeling depression, whether they had a pre-existing condition, as Dr. Silberman talks about, or not, to know they're not alone?
I think it's always validating to hear that you're not alone. And I think normalizing the experience, even for people who don't have anxiety or depression that they struggle with before the pandemic, I think everybody is a little bit more anxious and they're more isolated and they're having to come up with new coping skills and new ways of filling themselves up. And I think that although many people have Zoom fatigue, I do think that connecting with other people has been very powerful. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who've heard from people from their past. In particular, one of my clients heard from someone, and it was a 15-year-old break in a relationship and was sort of terrified to open the letter and opened the letter. And it was so beautiful and so powerful and so healing. And so I think in these times, there is this possibility where healing can really happen in relationships and people are seeking connection and seeking to reach out. So I encourage people to get support, reach out, talk to people who you know will help you to feel better, and really give yourself permission to do that.
Let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a chair. Be a part of this conversation. Give us a call. We've got Leanne on the line from Canton. Leanne, go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling regarding my beautiful father, who is currently in a assisted living facility. And I'm talking about pre and present COVID times where he has a psychiatrist. He's suffering from PTSD. Obviously, I can't see him now, but there is no psychologist that comes to see him for him to talk to. He's 78 years old. He has no idea how to use Zoom. He's very uncomfortable with it. And my dad and many people like my dad need additional services other than medication. And these facilities do not provide it. And it's heartbreaking.
I'm really sorry to hear that, Leanne. I can hear your concern for your dad. Let's turn to Dr. Edward Silberman. Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about the need for continuity of care, for continuum of care here, where we're falling down, where we can get stronger, kind of your reactions to Leanne.
Well, I'm not sure that I have expertise to know what the situation is on the ground at all these different kinds of facilities. And I think the situation is really quite different for everyone. For somebody in the situation that we've just heard about, it is tragic. People absolutely need more than medication for most things, but certainly for PTSD. And I think in a situation like this, we have to ask, what are the resources that are available and how can we best manage to use them? So for example, if you have an older person who is unlikely to be able to use Zoom and maybe nobody can go out to them and help them and teach them or help them, then, well, okay, what do you have? You have the telephone. The telephone is better than nothing. Some of my patients prefer just to have our sessions on the telephone and not with FaceTime or Zoom. Maybe they don't want to get out of their pajamas. And maybe for some of these people, I think that's just fine. And the phone conversations can be helpful. I think what the real issue is to make sure you do everything you can to avoid isolation, you can't avoid it, it's mandated, but to minimize the isolation. So to maintain contact with the person in any way possible. I don't know what the psychiatrist's practices are about maintaining contact with patients through that. Most, certainly at Tufts, and I think at most hospitals, all outpatient services have gone remote. And that simply is the way we do it, except in emergency situations. And I don't think any of us would prefer it to the way we usually work. But I think most of us feel that it is much better than not doing anything at all. So giving a person a chance to talk about the situation and to somebody who can understand and who listens and who can respond appropriately is enormously helpful.
I'd like to take another call here.
Another question. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, we've got still lots of callers on the line. I'd love to bring some more voices in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Dee on the line. Dee's calling from Myrtle Beach. Hey there, Dee.
Hi. Great show. Look, I'm a bit different.
Thanks.
I have a lot of friends that got laid off, and I didn't, and I'm feeling guilt. And when I talk to my friends who are hurting, what can I say to help them? Because I'm getting paid, I'm paying my bills, and I just feel awful. And I know what can I do to help them?
That's a great question, Dee. And figuring out ways, Susan Tone, to show up for other people who are suffering with empathy must be incredibly important right now. Do you have some advice for Dee?
Dee, that is such a great question. And I have to admit, I'm a foodie. So my first thought goes to food, which is you might be able to afford food that they can't. So maybe making a meal and bringing it by, and maybe, you know, you're down south, so maybe it's warm enough where you could put out a picnic blanket and be 6 feet apart from each other and be having a picnic with each other. I think that part of the challenge is in needing to know from your friends how comfortable they are receiving help from you at this time? Because as much as you're struggling with your feelings, my guess is that they are also having some feelings about the fact that you're still employed. And on a practical level, I would just want to make sure that they know about the resources out there and the grants that they could apply for in unemployment to make sure that they're getting all of the support that they can get financially.
I would have a comment too.
Yeah, please, Dr. Silberman, please.
From the emotional point of view, I think it's easy to underestimate the benefit of just being there for somebody and just listening and acknowledging the realities of the situation, whatever else you might be able to do from a practical point of view, but just to acknowledge, yeah, it stinks. And in many ways, it's just not fair. And don't let your discomfort and your guilt put more distance between you and your friends than you need to have, because that in the end will be a disservice to them, where you're hanging in with them will be probably more of a service just in itself than you might realize.
Dr. Silberman D is talking about a situation that's kind of unique to the moment. We've actually had a very strong economy up until relatively recently from an employment standpoint. And I wanted to ask you, are there other specific issues that you're seeing right now that are different from other times? And if so, what are they and how are they different?
Yeah, practically everything. it's got so many layers. We're in a situation where we have to be afraid for our health. We don't know for a given individual, we don't know just how afraid we have to be for ourselves or for our loved ones. We don't know how long it's going to go on. We are often in a situation where either there's been an economic impact or there might be an economic impact. And we don't know how much of an impact, and we don't know when we're going to find out. And we, as I mentioned before, we are deprived of many of the things that normally keep us going. And we have to quickly develop some kind of skill in making substitutions for them. And we don't know how long that's going to go on. And I think nobody alive has ever lived through anything exactly like this. And so we're all trying to do the best we can, but if anybody pretends to know all about it, your distance from that person should be a lot greater than 6 feet.
Dr. Silberman, I have to tell you, even I found it affirming to have you say, listen, this is different, right? Nobody else alive has had quite an experience like this. Susan Tone, you talked to our producer, Walt, a little bit about cognitive behavioral therapy and how it plays out differently with so many great unknowns. Can you kind of build on what Dr. Silberman was saying there?
Sure. I think that the lack of knowledge and how the knowledge that the science keeps producing for us keeps changing. It's ever changing, that you think you know in one moment something, and then maybe the next week it turns out that wasn't exactly right. So you begin to question, like, can we really know? Do we really know? Which creates more anxiety, I think. We like knowing, and then we can have a plan. And so CBT talks about unproductive worry versus productive worry. And the idea
just to review,
is that
that's cognitive behavioral therapy, right?
Yes. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, that's okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. So unproductive worry is when you're thinking about it and you're thinking about it and you're worrying about it and worrying about it, and it's swirling around in your head and there's no plan. Nothing lands on the paper as a plan. Productive worry is, I think about it, I think about all the parts of it, and then I sort of sit down and I make a plan. And so the challenge now is, it's hard to get into productive worry because we keep getting information that throws us back into unproductive worry. And I think there's this also a technique in cognitive behavior therapy, which is a part of cognitive restructuring, which is sort of the belief that thoughts drive feelings and behaviors. And sometimes we have thoughts that we call sort of thinking errors. And in this case, sometimes if somebody's worrying about, I'm afraid I'm going to get COVID-19 and I would, you know, I might, if I think, if it weren't this time, like I'm afraid I'm going to get whatever terrible disease. And I'm thinking statistically, that's not likely. So I might ask, how likely is that to happen? And we can look at actual statistics and we can know. Now someone could say, I'm just so worried about getting COVID-19. And it's hard for me to challenge it by saying, well, how likely is that to happen? Because actually it is pretty likely. And so it's taken away one of the tools that we have. I think the other tool that CBT
Susan,
would
I'm
use.
Sorry, I'm so I, yeah. I'm so sorry. I'm going to stop you there just because we have a caller who's dealing with some of this and we have limited time. I would love to go to this caller. She just popped up.
Sure.
So excuse me for interrupting. We're going to go to Linda in Pepperell. Linda, go ahead.
Hi. Excuse me. My name's Linda, and I'm a nurse, and I work at a hospital on the floor that I'm taking care of COVID patients. And I'll back up just a little. I have depression and anxiety that has been in remission. Because of my worry of getting COVID and bringing it home and possibly giving it to my family, I see some symptoms of depression and anxiety kind of creeping up again. In addition to working around COVID patients, I have a granddaughter that has become the love of my life, and I can't really see her right now because of trying to adhere to the social distancing. I have to either go by my daughter's house and see her through a chain link fence, or I've been able to FaceTime a couple times. So I do want to say that I appreciate this show. I appreciate you having this on right now, and I just wonder if there's any thoughts on what more I can do to try to just get a hold of all this.
Linda, I'm glad you called. I wish we had you sooner. We literally have 2 minutes left in the show. So Susan Tone and Dr. Edward Silberman, let's just each give Linda one thought that might support her in this moment.
So I would encourage Linda to think about everything she's always done to help her and to just accept that these are unprecedented times and she might have to come up with some new ways of coping with the anxiety and depression.
And Dr. Silberman.
My thought is what I'm hearing is normal and inevitable. And there's no way to get rid of it. And try not to feel bad about feeling that way, because you wouldn't be human if you didn't.
Linda, I hope that provides some comfort to you. I'm glad that you called in. And all the listeners that we didn't get to today, thank you for calling. You know we're here for you. You know we'll do more segments like this. So call in again when we can be supportive and helpful to you. In the meantime, I really want to thank our guests for this. Dr. Edward Silberman, psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Quite welcome.
And Susan Tone, Associate Professor of Clinical Practice at the Boston College School of Social Work and a licensed clinical social worker with a therapeutic practice. Susan, great to hear your voice. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in person next time.